Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
We're going to look at the Bible in the prophet Habakkuk tonight. The prophet Habakkuk, like so many of the prophets, is not introduced to us. He merely starts talking. And most prophets start talking and say, "You're in trouble. Thus says God, the Lord's really not happy with the way you've been doing stuff." But that's not the way Habakkuk starts. Last night at the One New Man gathering, we learned a song called "The Earth Shall Be Filled with the Glory of the Lord as the Waters Cover the Sea," which will be in this text tonight as well, in Habakkuk chapter 2. There are many famous phrases that we'll see as we peruse this book. It's only three chapters. We're going to cover it all at once. We're not going to do this in 3 weeks, merely 1 week, a night only. The oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw: "How long will I call for help and you will not hear? I cry out to you, violence, you don't save. Why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yeah, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists. Contention arises. So the law is ignored. Justice is never upheld. The wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, justice comes out perverted. Look, among the nations, observe, be astonished." Who's talking? Habakkuk is talking. To whom is he talking? To God himself. Wow, what chutzpah. His prophecy is not a prophecy. His prophecy is a complaint. How come you let me see wickedness and you're not fixing it? What's the point? And if I can see it, why don't you see it? And if you see it, why don't you fix it? So we think that the year 2012 is so new in this ball game of seeing injustice and violence and crookedness all over the planet. No. So it was around 620 to 590 BCE. That's when he's writing. And it's very possible that he was there when the Babylonians came and captured us. Take a look at the map. Google Assyria and Babylon in 6th century BC and you'll find a similar map. This is the Mediterranean Sea here on the west. I and J, Israel and Judah. Israel on the north, Judah on the south. Assyria, they're the ones who took us captive in 721 BC. And they took Israel captive, the northern kingdom. Now, they're the powerhouse at this time. But part of them is being ceded to the Babylonians. The Babylonians are taking some of the land and declaring independence. It's like Kashmir declaring independence. And Assyria, the powerhouse of the day, is losing power. The capital of Assyria is Nineveh. Capital of Babylonia, Babylon. So there's the basic geography. The fertile crescent is what we're looking at. It goes down to Egypt, and it's a crescent. And that's the only place where land was green. The Tigris and Euphrates rivers come up here. Everything else is sand. So that's the area. And once again, we have a Judean prophet. Last week, we saw one, the last 2 weeks, in Joel. And now we see another one in Habakkuk. And he is complaining. I don't know. I call it chutzpah. You got to be somebody with God to be able to talk to God like this. I love that in verse 5. Uvagoyim, look about in the nations. Come on, can't you see anything? Wow. Be astonished. Wonder. Because I'm doing something in your days. You wouldn't believe it if you were told. I'm raising up the Chaldeans. That's some people from Babylon. Chaldea. Chalde is a place in Babylon. Ur of the Chaldees. Who came from there? Abraham. That fierce and impetuous people who march, verse 6, throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. That's what's just happened. The Babylonians are rising in power. They're taking more world dominance. And they are, verse 7, dreaded and feared. There was a people who was dreaded and feared some centuries earlier in this very book, and it was the Hebrews. But because of our sin, we have failed or lost koyach, lost strength and power, and God has given that to others. Shocking. They're dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate with themselves rather than with God. Their horses are swifter than leopards. That's a little exaggerated. And all these things describe a real evil people in various categories of evil. They come for violence. They collect captives like sand, verse 9. That has to do with as easily as you pick up sand. as small a thing as a little bunch of powder you can pick up in your hand, go to the beach and pick up sand. Easy to do. And that's how they collected captives. They were so dominant a world force. It would be like the British in 1880. It would be like the Spanish in 1550. It would be like the Americans going into, where was it that Ronald Reagan sent them? Guyana? It was like the British going to the Falklands or Malvina back in Margaret Thatcher's day. Just big swoop in, takeover. And the other guys just say, here you go, here. Like sand, pretty docile. The Chaldeans mock verse 10 at kings, and rulers are a laughing matter to them. Not their own king, but other kings. In other words, they have no regard for government, which is what happens when you get full of your own power. Full of yourself, you think you are your own king, and therefore no other king has any relevance to you. When you ridicule government, you're not governed by government, and you are anarchy. And when you're filled with anarchy, that's going to come and bite you, as they say, in the wrong places. It is arrogant. And when you are arrogant, you are unrulable and therefore unruly. And then mobs try to rule. And we saw that in Greece regularly the last 2 years. Demonstrations, refusing to work, refusing to listen to government. And it's not just Greece. I mean, we can look at the Occupy movements around the globe. We can look at the hip-hop world as something very similar. Apologies to my son. It's a subculture within mostly young people. Not all young people. But it's a style of music, it's a style of dance, a style of graffiti, and etc. And waywardness is normative because governance is removed. In the world today of Facebook and Wikipedia, really I want to highlight Wikipedia more than anything, there is no authority. Wikipedia is the online encyclopedia, and you can add to it. There could be an entry for Bob Mendelsohn. There isn't, but you could create one. Well, then somebody else could add to that, and somebody else could add to that, and I might be over here saying, hello, that's not me, but I'm as authoritative as Joe Schmo from Kokomo, who's somewhere in Swaziland. So that the authority, when you were a kid, there was Collier's Encyclopedia and the World Book Encyclopedia. The Oxford Dictionary was the standard. Okay, Macquarie. Encyclopedia Britannica. And it's still accurate about Galileo. There was an authority in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And you could say, oh, I think that World War I started because of X, Y, and Z. But really, the answer was there in the Britannica. You'd look it up. There it is. The authority was set. And government was like that as well. But once you start knocking over and toppling authority and saying they are like me and I'm like them, when you lower them and raise you, then we have no authorities. And that is the downside of everyone having access to communicating what they think. I blog pretty regularly, and some people follow me. I wonder why. There are people who respond and who look at the blogs, and God bless them. But I'm just a fella communicating my thoughts. The last week, I've been writing a lot on God's fullness, and I spoke about that last night at the One New Man. And I wrote several about those the last week. But somebody else in Italy could be writing about it. Somebody else in South Africa could be writing about it. And all of a sudden, we're all the same. And therefore, nobody has authority. The diminution, the meaning of authority by the elevation of the little guy is exactly what this is rendering. They laugh at kings. I can be a king. I'm going to be the king of my own little circle on Google+. I'm going to be the king of my world in Facebook. I'm going to be, you get the idea. I tweet about kings. I don't need a king. They heap up rubble to capture it. Then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on, but they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. When your koach is your aloha, when everything that defines you is you, when your strength is found in you and not in the God who made you, then you are as capable as you are. We were talking before the meeting about teaching yourself an instrument or a language. You're only as good as yourself because you're your teacher. So the downside of self-teaching is your own mastery is your own level. It's good to have an authority. It's good to have somebody outside you. Their strength for the Chaldeans, for the Babylonians, was themselves. And they were full of themselves, up themselves, as we would say in Australia. And they were therefore weak. Strong when they're strong, when they find weaker people. You get it? You get the idea? This is God's answer to Habakkuk, saying, that these people are copying it, and they're going to cop it. You're looking right now. You want me to respond immediately. God says, basically, I'm long-suffering, which doesn't mean he's got an ache in his shoulder for a long time. Long-suffering is that Bible word that people don't use much anymore that means patience, perseverance, waiting and waiting and waiting. And we read in Peter that God does, 1 Peter 3. In 1 Peter 3, we see that in verse 18 and following, Yeshua died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and made proclamation to the spirits now in prison. They were once disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that's only 8 people, were brought safely through the water. The patience of God lasted throughout the construction of the ark. Any idea how long he was building that ark? 120 years. According to the book of Genesis, he said that man's day shall be 120 years. In other words, in 120 years, it's going to rain. And Noah started building the boat. It was a full year before they could disembark. They were in the boat for a full year. But the patience of God to wait for those people to come to faith, but only 8 actually came through.
Yeah, but was Noah preaching at that time?
Yeah.
For the 120 years?
Yeah, that's what they say. He was a preacher of righteousness, according to the book. So here he is telling the people across the street, I'm building this boat, and you better get in it. And there was plenty of room. It's a massive structure. It had never rained before. They'd never heard of rain before. And he's saying, no, there's coming a big flood. And some of you have seen the movie with Steve Carell where he plays Noah, and he's building it on and on. Look, the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah. I like that about God. Long-suffering means he's aching for those to come be with him. You've got to see that. That's why he's telling Habakkuk, relax. I see it. I've been seeing it. I'm not seeing it. They're dreaded, they're feared, but they're going to get it. All of them come for violence. They're going to get theirs. They, verse 11, will sweep through like the wind and pass on. Those whose strength is their God. Back to Habakkuk. So then Habakkuk has a second query. Well, now, wait a minute. Aren't you from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. You, O Lord, have appointed them to judge. And you, O Rock, have established them to correct? Wait a minute. You're the boss, and you're going to choose Chaldeans to judge Judah? These guys are idol worshippers. These guys are heretics. You're going to use them to judge your people? Verse 13, your eyes are too pure to approve evil. Actually, the Hebrew there is just ra'ah, to see evil, and he does a parallel here. And you cannot look on wickedness with favor. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Judah is more righteous than Babylon. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. Why would you use the bad guys to judge the good guys? There's nobody good, and God can use anybody. And who else is he going to use for a good guy to get judged but a bad guy? What other resource does he have? You need him to use only an angel? He's going to use people. Why are you silent? Why have you made men like the fish of the sea, like creepy things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away with their net, and gather them together in their fishing net. That's why they're rejoicing and glad. Therefore, they offer a sacrifice to their net, burn incense to their fishing net. These guys are pagans. They are idol worshippers. You're going to use them? Will they, verse 17, therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? God answers. This is probably one of the most famous passages in the text. Write down the vision. Inscribe it on the Luach tablets, that the one who reads it may run. If you write down the vision, it's not just for you, it's for those after you. So God is telling Habakkuk, write this down. It's not for you only, and it's not for now only. In fact, the vision, verse 3, is yet for the appointed time. It hastens towards the goal. It will not fail, though it tarries, wait for it, for it will certainly come. It will not delay. So relax. I'm going to answer in my good time, not yours. I'm patient so that they, even the Chaldeans, can come to faith, so that the Assyrians can come to faith. You know some famous Assyrians who came to faith? King of Nineveh, when Jonah went and preached. And in fact, all of Nineveh, it says, from the least of them to the greatest of them, believed what Jonah preached. Really? He gave them 40 days, 6 weeks. I'll give you 6 weeks and you're dead, said Jonah. The dread of Jonah and the God of Jonah was on the Ninevites, and they repented from the least to the greatest. If they even knew the story of how this guy rocked up, one day he's into town from Penrith to Bondi. He's walking across this three-day walk city, and in the first day he's preaching, and they give ear to him. Maybe because seaweed's all around him, maybe because he's an albino from the gastric juices. I'm not sure why, but somehow they listen to him, and God's grace was on them in such a clear way that now 6 weeks later, God does not destroy the Ninevites, the Assyrians. This is God, who is a patient, loving God, who longs for all people to come to him. As for the proud one, his soul is not right within him. And then here it is, the just will live by his faith. I want to talk about that with you for a while. It's quoted so much in the Newer Testament. It's quoted in Romans chapter 1, Galatians. It's in the book of Hebrews chapter 10. And then the Hall of Faith is chapter 11. But yeah, the just shall live by faith. This is a pretty significant thing. The rabbis say that there were 10 things like the commandments. And then let's simplify it because we need simplifying. So then there were 3 commandments. What were the 3? Micah chapter 6, verse 8. To do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. And then they say, well, let's simplify it down to 2 commandments. Love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. But then they say it all boils down to 1 commandment right here. The just shall live by his faith or faithfulness. And there's no real difference between emunah, which is faithfulness, and faith, which is the response to God. There's no real difference except the way you emphasize. On whom are you putting your trust? That's the real difference. The just shall live by his faithfulness. Listen to how that plays out. I'm a righteous man, so I'm going to be faithful to my wife. I'm going to be faithful to my husband, to my children, faithful to my job, faithful to God, do all these right things. So the just man, or the righteous, the tzaddik, has to be doing mitzvahs. Hear that. That's one angle on this. Now I want you to hear another angle. The just shall live by his faith in the only one who can make us righteous. You hear a difference in the nuance between statement A and statement B? If I talk about faithfulness, I'm talking about what I do. If I talk about faith, I'm really talking about what God does. It is slight. The same Hebrew word can be translated both, so it's a little dangerous here. But it was Martin Luther in 1517 who read this verse, and it overwhelmed him. I mean, he read it in Romans 1, but still, he read this verse, and it changed the planet. Martin Luther, who was a monk, a Catholic. I mean, what other Christian was there? Apologies to the Orthodox. They were only in the Western world, in Germany, there was only Catholics. And here he is reading this verse and saying, whoa, it's not about selling indulgences. It's not about papal authority. It's not about complying with the religion of the popes and the bishops. It's about faith in the only one who ever did enough to make me righteous with God. The righteous, the just, are those who live by faith. So the big phrase coming out of the Lutheran Reformation and the Wittenberg Door in the 95 Theses was sola fide, only faith. I'm going to trust God and my life will be new. So when you go and listen to Protestant missionaries from Billy Graham to Mark Landrum, when you listen to our friend, you're going to hear this. If you accept Jesus as your Savior, you'll be born again and you'll become righteous with God. That's pretty much the tagline on every good evangelical sermon, right? And what is that based on? It's based on this text. The just, the righteous, the tzaddikim, those who have been made righteous are those who have believed in the God who makes us righteous. But that's not new. Habakkuk is basically citing and revisiting this idea from Genesis when Abraham was made righteous. Abraham believed God, and God counted that, the faith, as righteous. So Habakkuk has it on good authority, Mosaic authority, biblical authority from before. And it was faith. It wasn't Abraham's faithfulness. It wasn't Abraham's duties, mind you. You can take this way out of context and say, I'm going to believe and not do anything. I'm going to believe and not care about people. I'm going to believe and not comply with biblical commands. Don't do that, because if you believe, if you love God, you'll keep his commandments. But the essence of keeping commandments is based on our relationship, not on our duty. So I've got to keep that ever in mind. The just doesn't live by his duty. The just doesn't live by his checklist. The the just lives by his faith. And that's where I want to be. John Wesley was another reformer a couple hundred years after Luther. And he often would say that we ought to each night evaluate our faith by checking what you did that day. Before he went to bed, he revisited his, if you will, in modern days, his itinerary, his schedule, his diary, his appointment book. What did I do that day? Did I bring honor to God? Did I love my wife and kids? Did I help the planet to be better? Did I preach the gospel? I prayed. These are good questions. And you can evaluate your faith on the basis of what you do. That's fair enough. And James would say, the demons believe. You say you believe in God. Whoop-de-doo. I think James's modern version would say, the demons also believe. And they tremble because they know that faith without works is dead. So you got to do stuff. But if you're doing stuff to please a God who requires stuff, you're missing it. But if you do stuff because you love and believe in the God who calls us into relationship, then you're doing right. The just will live by his emunah, by his faith. Wine betrays the haughty man, verse 5, so that he doesn't stay at home. He enlarges the appetite like Sheol. He's like death, never satisfied. Gathers to himself all nations, collects to himself all people. Won't they all take up a taunt against him? And then there are five woes that are listed from verse 6 and following. Woe to him who increases what's not, that's stealing. Verse 6. Creditors rise up suddenly. You've looted many nations. This is so true of the Chaldeans, and it's so true of governments today, and it's so true of those who want to get ahead by doing violence to their land. Second woe is verse 9, to him who gets evil gain for his house and puts his nest on high to be delivered from the hand of calamity, running away from things and self-protecting by cutting off many peoples from yourself. Number 3, verse 12, woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. There's so much darkness in nations crippling other nations and dominating. This is not the way it's supposed to be. Why? Because verse 14 says, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. You're going to love that song. It's from the album Never Forget, and it's fantastic. It's going to be our theme song at One New Man for a while. Verse 15 is the fourth. Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk. So there's this idea of accomplishing something by making the other guy weaker. You certainly hear about that in date rape. It's kind of a modern phrase, a takeoff on this, so as to look on their nakedness and do evil to them, really. And the fifth is in verse number 19. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, wake up! To a mute stone, arise! And that's your teacher. Idolatry, which is the summary of all wickedness, the end game of all breaking God's commands. Whatever it begins with, it ends with idolatry. Verse 18, what profit is the idol when its maker has carved it? That's so good. This idea of this pestle, this idol. There are lots of words for idols. That's not the usual one. But it's like a real diminutive. It's like a little nothing. It's like a non-entity. It's not even worth calling it. And so Paul writes to the Corinthians in chapter 8 of 1 Corinthians that same thing. These so-called gods who are nothing. He's got that reflection from Habakkuk. These idols are nothing. Why would you trust in your own handiwork? Its maker, there's the word yetzar, trusts in his own yetzer, his own work. The thing, so he's making it and he believes it. That's just ridiculous. Do you talk to people regularly about faith? Are you trying to share what you believe with those who don't yet believe? And one of the things that you hear a lot, certainly I hear it with frequency, is I believe in myself. I'm a pretty good person. And if there is a God, I'm sure he'll reward me. They're trusting in their own idolatry. They're themselves as king of their own world. Yikes. Danger zone. I feel like the red light ought to go off. Sounds like a siren. That's your teacher. Behold, it's overlaid with gold and silver. There's no breath at all inside it. There's no spirit at all inside it. But the Lord, verse 20, and this is cited a lot in a lot of places, is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. You'll see that at the beginning of prayer meetings. You'll see that at the front of some Pentecostal churches. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. The book of Ecclesiastes says, when you come into God's presence, don't bring a lot of words with you. Who's going to pray tonight? I will. Okay, Lord, be calm, be quiet. When you have your own private times with God, I hope you do. Hope you have good times with God and that your prayers are meaningful and that you have time where you talk and where where you don't talk. You ever do that? You ever have quiet times? Those are good times. You ever do that? I mean, prayer time, not just quiet, like where you're sitting by a lake, but where you're really talking to God without talking yet. That's what he's saying. To an idol, you have to talk, because you got to convince the idol what he's got to do. But to God, you don't have to talk. Not so much.
It also said that before you even talk, pray, God knows what you're going to say.
So should we bother him? Why do we need to talk to him? If he already knows.
So that we can cleanse our hearts.
He is a purifier.
So you reestablish your position with God.
You're the boss, I'm not. Yeah. And then when he answers, you know to whom to bring thanks. Whereas if you don't talk to him, you think, yeah, I'm pretty good. I got that thing sorted. Chapter 3, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet. He's only listed as Habakkuk the prophet twice. Chapter 1, introduction. Chapter 3, here it is again. This is his prayer. This is a convinced man who's brought two objections to the Lord. The Lord answered with five woes, and Habakkuk says, got it. You're right. I'm taking what you say on board. I have heard the report. And it's really, I've heard the hearing. It's the same word, Shema. It's the same as in Isaiah 53, who has believed our report? But it's the word based on the word Shema. A report is something you hear. It's not a document. Lord, I've heard the report about you, and I fear. Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. What a great summary, chapter 3, verse 2, of everything God has answered him. The world is a mess. Revive your work. Make it alive again in the midst of as many years as you need it to take. I wanted it yesterday. I'm going to trust in you. I fear you. That's the word fear. Yarah. There's no hiding it. And Lord, I really think you're cool. It's Lord, I'm scared. I have God phobia in the most holy way possible. Fearing God is not wrong. It's righteous. As long as you live by faith and not by cowardice. There was a belt behind my father's door that he rarely ever used. I can remember maybe one or two times. I was the third child, so I bet he practiced a lot on my big brother. If I talked to my big brother, he'd exaggerate it. He'd say, oh, every week he was beating me. And I don't know what's true anymore. But I know, but by the time I was along, I'm 6 years younger than my big brother, that there was a fear of my father's belt. Didn't have to bring it out. I just knew it was there. And then you mouth off and you got soap in your mouth because you said a bad word. That was bad enough. But that belt, he brought it out and he whacked me with it on the tuchus. Maybe I could still feel it right now. I mean, it was real. And it reinforced my daddy phobia, but not a horrible phobia. And it wasn't child abuse at all. It was appropriate. I had great respect for my father in my youth. I think I carried it on until he died. I think I still have it in measure. He didn't use that belt a lot. He just had it available, and I had respect for who he was. That's a good thing, and I use that as a human example of what God can and has done. When the Babylonians came and captured the Jewish people, the Judeans, in 586 BC, and took us back into Babylon, God was using lesser people, less righteous people, to accomplish God's purposes in bringing us to himself, to wake us up, to cause us to fear the Almighty in a righteous and holy way. Not that we would live in cowardice, but that we would live strong in faith. That's what it's about. The prayer goes on, that his splendor covers the heavens, the earth is full of his praise, radiance like sunlight. Before him goes pestilence, and plague comes after him. It's like everywhere God goes, there's good things and there's bad things. He stood, surveys it, ancient hills collapse, ways are everlasting, tents under distress. It's as if wherever God steps, he's like a giant in the land, and things are trembling when the Lord is walking through the place. He rages against rivers and is angry against seas. Chariots of salvation, your bow was made bare. Selah, it means pause, ponder it. Mountains, verse 10, quake. Mountains, quake. What? At the steps of God walking into the world to judge the world. Look at verse 13. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your Messiah. You struck the head of the house of the evil to lay him open from thigh to neck. Ponder that one. So when God raises up the Babylonians to judge the Jews, God will then judge the Babylonians for the justice they brought to the Jews. Do you understand that? It's like Adolf Hitler was used, according to some, to bring judgment on the Jewish people for the sins we had been committing in the 20s and 30s in Germany. And yet, I mean, they were the worst people. They were the Babylonians, if you will, in the story. But that's not the end of the story. So when the prophet says, come on, Lord, aren't you seeing? God says, buckle your seatbelt. I'm bringing the judgment on the German. I'm bringing it on the house of Hitler. I'm bringing it on the house of all these guys who did evil against my people. So in one way, he says, I'm going to bring the big fish to eat up you. But there's a bigger fish coming to eat up the ones who eat you up. The end of the story is not that they judged you. The end of the story is that I'm the judge of the whole earth. Can you handle that? Without that, we are going to look at an unjust God, that God will ever bring justice to bear on those who even do damage to us. Verse 17, though the fig tree should not blossom and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off in the fold and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord and rejoice in the God of my salvation. God is my strength. He's made my feet like hind's feet, makes me walk on high places, lam natseach, for the choir director, on my stringed instruments. It's like the musical notation, which is usually at the front, is now at the bottom of this one. So this was a song. Here's the theme, verse 17. Even though the fig tree's not blossoming today, and there's no fruit today on the vine, I'm still going to rejoice in God. In anticipation of what it's going to be. What do we call that in Bible terms? Faith. Even though I don't see it, I see it. The yield of the olive should fail and fields produce no food. Well, you can't eat from that. You're starving. He says, hang in there. Yet will I exult in the Lord and rejoice in the God of my salvation. A phrase that sounds like Romans chapter 5 all over again. A direct result of faith and his rejoicing in the God of his salvation. It's one of those things about faith that you don't have to see things. You don't have to see what's in front of you. If you can see it, it's not real faith, is it? Isn't that what Hebrews 11 says? Faith is the evidence of things not seen. So if I can see it, then it can't be faith. So it can only be faith if the flock's cut off from the fold and there's no cattle in the stalls. It's not presumption. It's confidence in the God who provides all things. The same God who's going to bring judgment on the enemies of the Jewish people. That is Habakkuk's testimony, and he wrote it into a song for the choir director. Habakkuk is about today. It's about an Iraq war. Habakkuk is about today. It's about a global financial crisis. Habakkuk is about today. It's about all the troubles of the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras. It's all those things, whether it's historic and 7th century B.C. or 21st century Australia, it's very relevant to us. And at the end of our evaluation of it, can we say, I will exult in the Lord and rejoice in the God of my salvation? If so, you've got it down right, and you're living by faith. There's a book. This is called From Meltdown to Mountaintop by Camille Magdaly, who is a friend. He lives down in Melbourne. Taking the high ground in times of trouble with help from Habakkuk. So the first 90 pages or so is all about the description of the troubles of today and the meltdown that is global everything. And then the last 70 pages alludes to some of these concepts that Habakkuk declares. It is really good reading, and especially now that we've covered it.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.